From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. An attempted coup orchestrated by the U.S. and involving opposition officials and senior military staff was thwarted by the socialist government of Venezuela Thursday and drew condemnation from across Latin America and the Caribbean. We begin with this report from Telesur's Cody Weddle in Caracas.
President Maduro says the plan, financed from the United States, included an attempt to assassinate him and the bombing of various targets in the capital, including the offices here of Telesur. Maduro says various members of the armed forces and a number of civilian politicians were involved, but the plot had been completely foiled.
Se trata de un intento de utilizar a un grupo de oficiales de la aviación militar para provocar un hecho violento.
It was an attempt to use a group of Air Force officers to provoke violence, carry out an attack, a follow-up from last year's coup attempts. I want to thank those young officers, the youth in the barrios, our intelligence and counterintelligence services, because thanks to all of them, we were able to follow this coup conspiracy for several weeks and foil it completely in time.
Porque gracias a la actuación conjunta pudimos hacerle seguimiento durante varias semanas a este intento de golpe de Estado.
The president of Venezuela's National Assembly, Diosdado Cabello, released the names of the Air Force officers involved.
Entró en fase terminal. Lo dijo el señor Enrique Capriles la noche del 14 de abril.
Capitán Héctor José Noguera Figueroa.
These are the names of the officers involved in the coup attempt. Captain Hector Jose Noguera Figueroa, on the run. Jose Suarez Romulo, on the run. Division General Maximiliano Hernandez Vázquez. He's a former commander of the Air Force. Major Cesar Arnoldo Pérez Carrero. First Lieutenant Wilfredo Amado Castillo Colmenares. First Lieutenant Henry Javier Salazar Moncada, under arrest. First Lieutenant Miguel Ángel Salazar Molina, he's not been arrested yet. First Lieutenant Carlos José Esqueda Martínez, under arrest. First Lieutenant Jafre de Jesús Pineda Trejo, and First Lieutenant Ricardo José Antich Zapata, he has just been arrested.
Primer Teniente Carlos José Esqueda Martínez, detenido actualmente.
The mayor of Libertador, the Libertador municipality here in Caracas, and leader of the United Socialist Party of Venezuela, Jorge Rodriguez, said that the person who chose the targets for the plot was the prominent opposition leader, Julio Borges.
Este señor General Hernández, del que el presidente mencionó, que ha declarado.
This general that the president referred to, General Hernandez, has declared, and the evidence backs us up, that he was going to make a recording. Fortunately, they were never able to make the video recording. But we have the text of the message that was going to be read. He says, and I'm very aware of the gravity of this, that it was the opposition leader and MP, Julio Borges, who chose the strategic targets.
Now, according to plans found on a computer belonging to those arrested, the targets included several public buildings and locations. The plan was for a military Tucano jet to fly over Caracas and bomb several strategic points, like the headquarters of military intelligence and the nearby Telesur building in the east of the capital. Now, they also intended to bomb Plaza Venezuela. That is one of the busiest spots in the center of the city here in Caracas, as well as the city hall of the Capital District. The public sector's office and the Ministry of Defense, as well as the Miraflores Presidential Palace, were all on the target list. With these attacks, the plotters apparently intended to create chaos and sow panic among the population. The president of Telesur, Patricia Villegas, has condemned the plan to attack the television channel's headquarters here in Caracas. On her Twitter account, Villegas wrote, quote, "Part of the planned coup against President Maduro was an attack on Telesur in Caracas." She went on, quote, Telesur's headquarters is not just a building full of aerials and satellite dishes. More than 700 people work in this main building that was a target. In another tweet, she said, quote, "It is the lives of Telesur's workers and that of our neighbors that were at risk. If they attack Telesur, the impact would be widespread." Villegas invited followers to condemn the plans of the attempt using the hashtag Somos Gente Telesur, in English that translates to We Are the People of Telesur.
U.S. State Department spokesperson Jen Psaki rejected the accusation of U.S. involvement at her daily press conference Friday.
President Maduro last night went on the air and said that they had arrested multiple people who were allegedly behind a coup that was backed by the United States. What is your response?
These latest accusations, like all previous such accusations, are ludicrous. As a matter of longstanding policy, the United States does not support political transitions by non-constitutional means. Political transitions must be democratic, constitutional, peaceful, and legal. We've seen many times that the Venezuelan government tries to distract from its own actions by blaming the United States or other members of the international community for events inside Venezuela. These efforts reflect a lack of seriousness on the part of the Venezuelan government to deal with the grave situation it faces.
The U.S. has a longstanding practice of not promoting, what did you say? How longstanding is that? I would, in particular, in South and Latin America, that is not a longstanding practice.
Well, my point here, Matt, without getting into history, is that we do not support, we have no involvement with, and these are ludicrous accusations.
In this specific case.
Correct.
But if you go back not that long ago, during your lifetime, even.
This is the not last that 21 long years? Since, that,
well done. Touche. But, I mean, look, does longstanding mean 10 years in this case? I mean,
my intention was to speak to this specific reports.
But you said it's a longstanding U.S. practice, and I'm not so sure. It depends on what your definition of longstanding is.
Okay.
Whatever we say about Ukraine, whatever, the change of government in the beginning of last year was unconstitutional. And you supported it. The Constitution was not, absurd.
President Evo Morales issued a statement of solidarity with his Venezuelan counterpart Friday after being informed of the U.S.-backed coup attempt against the country's democratically elected president. The action followed a statement last Saturday by the group of the 120-nation non-aligned movement rejecting the latest set of sanctions imposed by the U.S. against Venezuelan officials last week. The non-aligned movement almost prophetically described the sanctions as, quote, intended to undermine Venezuela's sovereignty, its political independence, and its right to self-determination, closed quote. We'll discuss this further with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, later in this newscast. Greece continues to wrestle with the EU over its debt and austerity. We begin with this report from Press TV.
The Greek prime minister warns that the EU cannot pressure Athens into breaking the anti-austerity promises it made to voters. Alexis Tsipras says his government does not blackmail and will not be blackmailed on the EU bailout deal. Tsipras stressed that Athens considers the current bailout agreement no longer existent. The Greek prime minister further said the troika of Greece's creditors, that is, that oversee the bailout should also be scrapped. He added that technical discussions with the Eurogroup institutions to ease the bailout terms for Greece will begin on Friday. That was earlier decided during talks with the head of the Eurogroup, Jerome Gisloblum. Now, Eurogroup has agreed to consider Greece's proposals for a fresh bailout deal in make-or-break talks on Monday.
And as Greece's leftist government confronts the EU and the neoliberal austerity that's been strangling the country, surprise help may be coming from new quarters, the socialist countries of Latin America, including Venezuela. The foreign ministers of both Venezuela and Ecuador will arrive in Greece Saturday to sign bilateral agreements with the new leftist government. The visit was announced Thursday from Moscow during a meeting between Ecuador's foreign minister, Ricardo Patiño, Venezuela's foreign minister, Delcy Rodriguez, and the Russian energy minister, Alexander Novak. First on the agenda, agreement between the South American nations and Greece in the fields of industry, shipping, and tourism. Analysts have drawn comparisons between the victory of the anti-austerity Syriza party in Greece to the pink tide of leftist leaders who won elections throughout Latin America over the past decade and a half. The Ecuadorian foreign minister pointed out that his country and others in Latin America and the Caribbean have had experience in solving the problems which now plague Greece. The Greek government is currently working with its Eurozone partners to renegotiate its debt, an experience a number of countries in Latin America have already faced. Thursday's announcement of the meeting was followed by an announcement Friday that the European Central Bank has agreed to give Greek banks $5.7 billion U.S. dollars in additional emergency loans. Greece has been pressuring the bank for access to short-term lending facilities since it disqualified Athens for standard borrowing terms. The so-called emergency liquidity assistance was extended through February 18th, with a requirement for further loans that the EU and Greece reach an agreement by February 28th. The new Greek prime minister has said one of his priorities is a fair and mutually beneficial deal with creditors, but that recession-hit Greece cannot recover without significant debt reduction and an end to austerity. The Latin American official's visit to Greece was requested by Venezuela's president, Nicolas Maduro, who warmly welcomed the victory of Syriza in the Greek elections in January. He has also invited the Greek prime minister to visit Venezuela. Maduro said the election of the leftists in Greece was an important development in what he called the, quote, great battle for the European people's dignity, independence, and right to live, close quote. A day after a ceasefire agreement was reached in Minsk over the civil war in Ukraine, the U.S. State Department accused Russia of sending military equipment and personnel into the eastern part of the country.
We are very concerned about continued fighting along and beyond the line of contact, including in heavily populated civilian areas, and reports of additional resupplies of tanks and missile systems coming across the border from Russia in the past few days. And I have a little more detail of that. I just want to go into for a moment here.
That was State Department spokesperson Jen Psaki at her Friday press conference.
The Russian military has deployed a large amount of artillery and multiple rocket launcher systems around Debaltseve, where it is shelling Ukrainian positions. We are confident that these are Russian military, not separatist systems. The Russian military also has air defense systems deployed near Debaltseve. We are also confident these are Russian military, not separatist systems. Russian units along the border with Ukraine are preparing a large shipment of supplies to pro-Russian forces fighting in eastern Ukraine. This is clearly not in the spirit of this week's agreement. All parties must show complete restraint in the run-up to the Sunday ceasefire, including an immediate halt to the Russian and separatist assault on Debaltseve and other Ukrainian towns. Clearly, the same options that have been on the table remain on the table. And obviously, we'll be watching closely to see what happens over the course of the coming days.
Where the information on the Russian equipment is coming from, where it's not coming from Senator Inhofe's office, I hope.
No, it's coming from our own internal information we were able to make
U.S.
public.
U.S. information, not Ukrainian
Correct.
Information. Okay.
But when pressed for proof, Psaki refused to offer any evidence.
Go ahead.
Hi, Jim. Would you be willing to present the evidence that you have? Because this is what the Russians keep saying, that all of these allegations from the American side are just words. They've been asking for evidence to be presented to, I don't know whom, to the international community, I guess, to the press.
Well, I think that's quite quaint, because not just the United States, but I'm getting to my point.
Right.
The United States, the Ukraine, Europeans, NATO, there are a range of officials around the world who have consistently conveyed. There have been information put out by NATO over the course of time. I'm sharing with you information that I'm able to share from our own internal analysis. I don't have more details to provide. We always make efforts to provide as much information as we possibly can.
Jen, I understand. We all say the same thing is not proof. You all say the same thing.
Well, I would
you
point you to
the
what
same,
the
yes,
Prime Minister
the
of Ukraine said when he offered his glasses to his Russian colleagues so that they could see what's happening
right.
in Ukraine.
Right.
Today's claim followed an incident earlier this week where photographs offered as proof of Russian tank and troop deployments turned out to be film of a military exercise from 2009. RT's Lizzie Phelan has more.
It appears that a senior Ukrainian delegation, which included members of the Ukrainian parliament, have presented fake evidence of Russian military presence in Ukraine to the U.S. Senate's Armed Services Committee. Now, the evidence included at least three photos that they labeled as exclusive, first-hand proof of a massive Russian invasion. The problem is, not only were those photos not exclusive at all, but they were taken in an entirely different place, no less than 7 years ago. The first photo was taken in South Ossetia in 2008, and the second in Russia. Both belong to the Associated Press News Agency. And the third is also clearly not exclusive at all, but has been stolen from Agence France-Presse. And it shows anti-government forces there in East Ukraine. The senator which made those photos public is Jim Inhofe, a Republican from Oklahoma. Senator Inhofe's communications director said that these photos were presented to the Senate's Armed Services Committee, which oversees all legislation concerning the U.S. military. And when the fraud quickly became public, the senator said that he was furious that the evidence had been falsified. Now, if we take a closer look at the Ukrainian delegation which provided this false evidence, we'll find at least three members of the Ukrainian parliament and many people directly involved in Kiev's military operation in East Ukraine. So the question is, why did they do it? Well, in the original article, when the photos were published, the Washington Free Beacon said, and I quote, "The new evidence could help bolster the case on Capitol Hill for a new piece of legislation that would enable the U.S. to provide lethal military aid to the Ukrainians who have been asking America for such support for months." Now, all it took was a quick Google search to expose this so-called evidence as fake. But like in the cases of Iraq and Libya, for example, what's worrying is that had the ruse succeeded, it wouldn't have been the first time the U.S. had taken military action based on false premises.
Political writer John White spoke with RT's Marina Dzhashi and offered his assessment of the motives underlying Washington's repeated claims of a Russian invasion.
It's purely based on fiction. There is a policy agenda with regard to Russia, with regard to NATO expansion, with regard to the expansion of the EU, with regard to isolating Russia. And everything is tailored to fit that policy agenda, including the truth. So anything that can be done to enlist support, the key determining factor, of course, is public opinion, both in the UK and the US in particular, which has just had a decade of war. The public is war weary. So they have to ramp up the demonization of Russia. They have to fabricate Russia's intentions and Russia's actions in order to enlist that support of public opinion when it comes to possibly intensifying the conflict, which I fear is we are in danger of seeing happen.
An attempted coup orchestrated by the U.S. and involving opposition officials and senior military staff was thwarted by the socialist government of Venezuela Thursday. For more on this, we spoke with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, via Skype from Nicaragua Friday. We've got all these things that are going on around the world, but there was a hot item just a little while ago, an attempted coup in Venezuela, and maybe we can come to that later. But you sent me the piece from Prensa Latina that talks about a delegation from Venezuela and Ecuador just leaving talks in Moscow with the oil ministry there and headed to Greece, while Greece is arm wrestling with the EU, and Russia has already said that, hey, well, we're not against giving Greece some bailout money if that's what it comes down to. The talks in Ukraine with an agreement at least for a ceasefire and some fallout from that. And in addition to that, at the UN Security Council yesterday, the expansion of the anti-ISIL sanctions to all terrorist groups, which means that includes, and it was named on the floor in the discussions, the United States, Saudi Arabia, and Qatar backing the so-called moderate rebels.
I didn't manage to see that piece, Tom. That's a very, very important development.
That happens in the context. That happens in the context of the new configuration on the Security Council that came into office last month and China's presidency. If they look at, let's say that Syria comes in next week and says, "Here's a bunch of financial transactions and weapons shipments that took place from the United States to this group of terrorists who are now considered terrorists for the purposes of this UN resolution. Let's vote on sanctioning the United States." You have a majority that might go that way.
Well, yeah, sure.
So that,
but that's, yeah. I mean, that's very old, isn't it? I mean, in terms of precedents, and if one looks for international precedents, the International Court of Justice condemned the United States for its terrorist actions against Nicaragua back in 1986.
That's correct.
You know, so in terms of international institutions, the United States profile as a kind of recidivist offender in terms of international terrorism is well established.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I'm really grateful to you for alerting me to that. I hadn't seen that at all.
Yeah. So anyway, let's talk about
the ISIS and the ISIL.
So go ahead. You sent me the piece about Greece, so let's start there.
Well, and perhaps the best starting point is a conversation that I had something like 2 or 3 weeks ago now with my colleague Jorge Capellan, who does a lot of work with Russia Today, and I think with Russia Today's Spanish program and with Russia Today's English language program as well.
Mm-hmm.
Talking about Latin America, and I had this conversation with him, and he and I have been kind of arguing between ourselves about, you know, what's going on in Spain and what's going on in Greece, and to what extent one can demand that the Podemos movement and the Syriza movement stick to an agenda that would be in accordance with what Latin American progressives would support. And his argument is, he's a much more kind of sane person than I am in many ways. And his argument is that one can't demand of movements like Podemos in Spain or Syriza in Greece or anywhere else in Europe that they somehow magically transcend the real concrete economic and social conditions that they're having to confront. And of course, and what happens here in Latin America is that when one looks at comments about what's going on in Latin America or Nicaragua or Venezuela or Argentina in among Western radical and progressive circles, that we regard that comment as hopelessly unrealistic.
Right. That's right.
But we ourselves are guilty of the same sin, if you like, in terms of what we expect from our progressive and radical colleagues in Europe, in Spain and Greece. Mm. So, mm. And what Jorge's comment is, you know, we can't expect people in Greece and Spain to be something different or do something more than we're capable of here in Latin America facing our own complicated situation. And that's very relevant to Venezuela, of course, and it's very relevant to Argentina, relevant to Nicaragua, and, as well as Ecuador and Bolivia. Sorry, there's a phone going off in the
background.
That's
okay. I hear it. That's all right.
So,
well, let me say while you're there.
Sorry, Don. That was a long preamble into saying something very brief about what's happening with this visit from Venezuelan and Ecuadorian diplomats that have just been to Moscow, and now they're on the way to Athens to talk to the new authorities in Greece. Is that there's a kind of spillover from what is happening here in Latin America in terms of answering the question, what can we do to improve the social, economic and civil and political and total rights of ordinary people in our countries, given our real situation within the context of a world dominated by corporate capital?
Right.
And that's, you know, that spillover is going to continue, and it'll be fascinating to see how that pans out in Greece and Spain over the next couple of months.
You know, in the process of critiquing it, they are actually working it. I mean, first of all, by offering solidarity, you know, Venezuela, the current oil market notwithstanding, Venezuela actually has capital to throw around to help, as it has done using its oil and oil revenue throughout Central, South America, and the Caribbean, which in a way, in a large way, helped finance a lot of the original integration that took place in the region that is now, you know, permeating the region. And so as it's almost like a contagion with them now going over to sit with Greece. And again, in the context of Russia having said, you know, we are not averse to helping to bail out Greece. And as Russia goes, perhaps the BRICS countries go, which includes China, which has a whole lot of money to throw at just about anything.
Yeah, I remember. I don't know if you read this article that I wrote, Don, but I wrote an article something like 5 years ago now, why doesn't Ireland join ALBA?
Right.
and the logic of the article was, because back then the Irish government had just taken what even officialdom has recognised to be an insane decision to guarantee the private banking sector's debt. Mm. And what they did with that decision was bail out huge German and French and Dutch and Belgian banks who were going to go bankrupt if Ireland didn't guarantee the debts of its private banking sector, which is pretty very much what happened in the United States as well, in a different and from a different angle.
Right.
And at that time, Ireland, you know, Ireland has gone through what Greece has gone through, but not to such an extreme extent as Greece, because Ireland didn't have so much debt with Germany. And it's the German government and the German private banking sector that are being so cruel and brutal towards the people and government of Greece in terms of restructuring debt and so forth.
Ireland's situation was
somewhat different.
Yeah, I mean, the Germans have had no problem inflicting cruelty on Greece over the past 70 years or so.
Yeah, sure. And of course, the Greek government, the new Syriza administration, pointed out to the German government that, as far as they're concerned, they still have business pending from the Second World War.
That's right.
So anyway, and that's another way. That's Greece. That's Europe. Why I was writing about Ireland and ALBA was because people in Ireland at that time, 5-6 years ago, were complaining about, well, how on earth are we going to cope with our balance of payments, blah-de-blah. And one of the obvious answers was, well, cut your energy bill. And one of the ways that Caribbean and Latin American countries have cut their energy bill is by entering into this preferential oil and other energy agreements with the Venezuelan government under the Petrocaribe scheme, whereby they only pay half their oil bill immediately within 90 days, and the other half they pay over 20 years. And that, you know, obviously for a country like Ireland, if you look at Ireland's energy bill, that would have saved them something like $400 million a year, which is peanuts in US terms, but it's a lot of money in terms of the very small Irish economy with a population of only 4 or 5 million, you know. So, and back then, that was an argument. It was a provocative argument, perhaps, but it was, from my point of view, is a very sensible argument, because and that argument is one that's been reflected in the behavior of states here and throughout Latin America, even right-wing governments like the Guatemalan government that is a member of the Petrocaribe agreement, and that enables it to cut its immediate obligations in terms of energy payments by half and extend the rest over 20 years. And of course, that's a huge benefit to their annual cash flow.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so in terms of Greece, what could be more logical than two members of OPEC, Venezuela and Ecuador, leaving a non-OPEC oil producer like Russia and going to talk to the government in Greece about possible ways of easing their cash flow problems over the next 12 months?
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.